book processing, so you weren't able to share the meeting for today. But the rules of parliament allow us to elect an ex-chairperson for this particular meeting. So I'm going to facilitate that for that we elect an acting chairperson for the meeting of today as well. Honourable members, can we nominate an acting chairperson for the meeting of today? Can I note Honourable Mokwena?
Secretary, Honourable Secretary, I have proposed the name of Honourable Dr. Karen.
Honourable Mokwena is nominating the name of Dr. Kurno. Any second up? Honourable woman?
Yes, thank you. I second that nomination. Dr. Kurno?
Honourable woman, thank you, Dr. Kurno. I don't think there's any other nomination. Objection? None. Honourable Kurno, may you please take the chair. Thank you.
Thank you, members. And can I extend a word of welcome to, first of all, to all members of Parliament from the Portfolio Committee. Secondly, all the officials, the media, guests, and more importantly, the CEO from Eskom, Mr. Brian Lammers, and your team from Eskom. This is probably one of the more important briefings in a long period that we're going to listen to from Eskom in specific. Late last year, we said that we will call Eskom to the Portfolio Committee to Parliament early in 2013 to come and address us on the state of the power system, and secondly, to what is the state of the securing of coal resources for power generation. And we're really happy that that finally we can come to this point in time that you can make a presentation not only to members of this portfolio committee but also to Parliament and for that matter to the nation. We saw the media reports this morning of your statements yesterday, and I think it's appropriate that you have an opportunity to address Parliament this morning and inform Parliament about the status of these two important subjects. I first want to thank Mr. Dalmas and your team for making the presentations or giving the presentation, copies of the presentations to members of Parliament up front. That really assists members to prepare we thank you for taking the trouble to do that. On these two subjects, the security of energy supply and the securing coal resources for power, I think what we in summary want to learn from Eskom this morning is first of all learn about your challenges that you have, and they may be many. And then secondly, to inform Parliament what needs to be done to keep the lights on. And that need to answer what is Eskom doing in this regard. And you have many challenges regarding the two major projects, infrastructure rollout projects on Maduki and Sile. You have serious challenges on non-payment of electricity, cable theft, illegal connections and others. But also what needs to be done by consumers to keep the lights on. And I see you talk in your statements about a change in behavior. So we need to talk about that. And then also, it may be more problematic, how do you plan for the unpredictable? We saw some unpredictables recently, like a Coburg unit, like the VOSA or RASA system that ran into problems. And then, thirdly, maybe just to go beyond the immediate challenges for the coming winter, because we're moving into the winter system period with your maintenance, excessive maintenance that you have to do. But look at the future demand for electricity beyond 2017. And have we gained the capacity and experience now to address issues on 2017 and beyond? Because that is a major concern for all of us in the industry, that you can give us the assurance that we will have to construct further power plants and we have to rely on further supply of coal. Maybe in this regard, you might want to brief a committee on comparisons of cost and experience to generate 1 kilowatt of electricity, your experience of state-of-the-art technology versus functional technology. Just going into the future, how do we utilize this experience and capacity that we're building to go into 2017 and beyond? And then lastly, if there's any policy clarity or ambiguity that you may battle with, you have the chance to address the legislature out of Parliament on what may be the interventions needed in this regard. So this is just a background, just to emphasize, members, I think this is really one of the more important briefings in a long period of time, appropriately now, in April 2013, that we invite ESCOM to come, and I think we welcome you in this regard. Before we start, what we traditionally do, we introduce ourselves, and then we will immediately hand over to you. So I'm first going to ask members of Parliament to introduce, of the Portfolio Committee to introduce themselves, then all the other guests, everybody in the room must stand up and state your position and who you represent, please. Then it's more familiar and we know who we have here. Can I start with a member right at the back, Honourable Marais? I think you on the... Let's start with you.
Yes, Marais, also member of the Portfolio Committee.
Natasha Michael, member of the Portfolio Committee.
Good morning. My name is Chris Hollows. I'm a member of the committee.
My name is Albert Mugwela, member of the Portfolio Committee.
Good morning. My name is Connie September.
Good morning. I'm Gloria Goldman, a member of this committee.
My name is Gerard Koorn, a member of the committee, and I'm representing the chairperson, Mr. Peter Moleka, who fell ill over the weekend, and he submitted his apology. He cannot attend. He will not attend the week in Parliament, so we wish him a speedy recovery. Then I'll start here with the Secretary. And
morning, Tisango Chimik, Secretary for the Court.
Morning, my name is Wadnem Nesi, Candidate President to the Court.
Good morning, I'm Linda from ESCOM.
Just like your position at ESCOM.
I'm the Chair Manager for Government Relations and Parliamentary Affairs at ESCOM.
Morning everyone, my name is Anne Sodad, I'm a committee assistant.
Hi, I'm Libra Moore, I'm the parliamentary researcher.
Good morning, my name is Tawum Konye from the Sanditans.
Bulilani Philip at ABC.
Rich Davies, author.
I'm
Percival Young from ENE's ENTA.
I find that
later from APDC. Parliament Liaison Officer, DPE.
Makalom Bunelo from ESCO.
Lindley Donnelly from the Mail and Guardian.
Before we get to the other team of ESCO, Mail and Guardian, and the two cameramen. Now over to Islam to introduce your team. You want to do it individually or Mr. Thomas, you want to?
I'm in the kitchen. Kerry Duffy, spokesperson for Islam.
Sylvia Martini, I'm actually from the Department of Public Supplies.
I'm Sylvia Marat, the Division Executive of Primary Energy in Islam.
My name is Ben Bassani. I'm the Group Executive for Commercial and Technology at ESCOM.
Thomas, Chief Executive of ESCOM.
Morning, Karen, the Chief Parliamentary Trade Manager at ESCOM.
Thank you so much. Now we know one another. Can we start? Is it MMS? Anything else that we... Yeah, sorry. I'm with you. Thank you. Can we start the presentation? Thank you so much, and you're most welcome. I've arranged, I had a word with Mr. Dalmas. There are two presentations, and with your permission, members, we're going to look at the first one, the state of the power system, and then deal with it, ask questions about it, and then immediately go into the second one, the securing the coal resources, and then have a discussion on that. Can we agree on that procedure? You're most welcome, and we hand over to you.
Chairman, thank you, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. Let me first start off by apologizing for the chairman of ESCOM. He's unfortunately not with us this morning. He's put on business. Chair, if we do not address all the matters that you have raised in our presentation, we welcome to respond to those, and we will provide you with written comments if required, if we've not been able to get to everything that you're looking for. Chair and the members of the committee, this is a presentation we shared yesterday with the public. We do this, and I've been doing this for some time, in order to be making sure that we communicate very transparently the status of the power system and what we have achieved for the last quarter, and give everybody a sense of what they can expect going forward. Now, every year, ESCOM prepares a winter plan, and we do the same with the summer. And this is essentially the focus of our winter plan, so that is what we will focus on. We will also give you a sense of some of our work we've been doing around the medium-term perspective around how do we look after our own generation fleet that currently exists, and we'll draw some conclusions, and then we'll get into the whole supply presentation. The first slide, really, if we just go back and look at some key messages around this specific winter. One is that this winter will be different in that we will be doing maintenance this winter. And really, we got to the point that nine of our generating units, so it's not nine power stations, it's nine units, that really requires some long-term maintenance between April and August. That's different because we normally do all our maintenance in summer and actually do a minimum in winter. This year will be different in that we will be doing maintenance. The efficient capacity that we have available to meet the demand for most of the day. Really, when we get into winter, our primary concern goes toward evening, between 5 o'clock and 9 o'clock, where the country experiences a significant peak demand. We believe that it's more than doable with the support of customers to reduce that demand over that peak period. And that gives us, we think, more than 2,000 megawatts will be more than adequate to ensure security of supply within the power system over the peak period. I must say to members that if you think about our generation in the day, if you think about the South African typical day in winter, we all get up in the mornings, we go to work, so there's a bit of a peak in the morning, and then everybody works. And when we go home, the power demand rapidly increases from 5 o'clock onwards. Actually, between 5 o'clock and maybe 7 o'clock, it increases significantly. And it's because we all go home. Remember, the factory stays the same. They don't start generating or working at 5 o'clock. But most residential customers go home. It becomes dark at the same time and the street lights come on. And so you have this massive increase in demand. And that is really in winter what really is our focus area. The residential customers, particularly those that uses the biggest users of electricity, geysers, space heating, and pool pumps, can make a difference in switching off this equipment for 4 hours. That's all we're asking for, 4 hours over that peak period. And that certainly will yield the savings. Yesterday, in the media briefing, one of our team members gave an indication that if 4 million homes would switch off their geysers, that would do it in terms of what one would need over. And you would still have hot water for that perspective. So we're really talking about those big energy users in the residential sector over that period of time and how we can deal with that. We have completed the 5-year review of our maintenance requirements. So we've looked carefully at the power demand that we project forecast in the country, the current fleet that we have and the new world. And for us, it's very important to create a very sustainable generation fleet. We have a massive fleet of power stations. So 27, we run one of the world's largest power fleets. It's very important for the country that it stay maintained and looked after. And we're committed to doing the maintenance of necessity in order to ensure its sustainability and the long-term supply requirement of the country. In short to medium term, because we're going to set very specific requirements for us to take our plant off to do maintenance, to make it predictable, because of the unpredictability of many other things, obviously this introduces the risk of balancing the supply and demand. In order to manage these, it's very important that we continue as a country look at additional supply options beyond even with the, what we're currently building, Madupi and Christina. But as a country, we continue to focus on energy efficiency, and we have for some time, certainly 2010, we have been saying that the country needs a safety net, and we've always proposed that that be in the form of a mandatory energy conservation scheme. As Eskom, we are committed. We have been to Madupi last week. We have taken the media there. We've shown you the project and gave you an indication of what we're doing. We're committed to completing our new build process. These stations are being built. They will be finished. And that's very important to make sure that we have necessary power capacity in the country. And I give the committee the assurance that we certainly bring all our own resources to bear to make sure this happens, and similarly that of our partners and contractors that are working on that program. If we look at an overview of where we're at, we have kept the lights on during the summer, and we have done so over the past 5 years. But Africa has not experienced load shedding over the last few years. If there were power interruptions in the country, they were essentially due to distribution issues, either on the Eskom side or, for that matter, in the supply side on the case of municipalities. Going into this winter, it's certainly we're facing some new challenges, particularly some of our capacity being down on maintenance. And again, we've always said, you know, will Eskom alone be able to keep the lights on? No, but we, with the support of what all of us as consumers can do, can certainly make sure that we can keep the lights on. It's very clear that our power stations are aging, and they're certainly operating at higher loads. We run them quite hard, given the delay in investment decisions in the country. And the sustained levels of high unplanned maintenance or planned maintenance is then needed to make sure the stations are reliable. It is like taking your car in that is getting older in for its regular routine service. It's exactly the same thing. These equipment is a lot more complex, but it's very important that you have higher levels of planned maintenance. What has changed for us over the last summer season has been particularly the three big events. Firstly, we had the failure of a transmission line from Mozambique due to the flooding in Mozambique. Prior to that, since July last year, on the Mozambican side, the power from Cotabato comes in from a substation in Mozambique with the transmission line directly into South Africa. We have upgraded for the last few years on our side the substations. They have not done this. So in July last year, they experienced a reliability issue with one of the big, what they call, smoothing reactors. And we had to take one of our spares and ship it to at least restore the power. Now, that is something that is quite a significant challenge to get the 400-ton piece of equipment from South Africa into a rural area in Mozambique, including building roads and shipping it on the sea. That has now been done. Yesterday morning, the line that was impacted by the flooding was returned, and the cooling reactor has been installed. NESCOM will be receiving 1,300 megawatts of 1,500 megawatts that it's due to get. So that is one big issue that has impacted our plans for the past summer. The second one was an unplanned outage at Kubuk, one of Kubuk Unit 1. That unit has returned to service yesterday as well, as we've indicated it would, and it's busy loading to full load. The committee will also recall that we've had some strikes at one of our lost coal suppliers, Zaro, and really what we do in that case, when we have an impact from a mine, we actually reduce the load at our power stations during the day. And to some extent, it goes to over 1,000 megawatts. So that during the day, you conserve coal to have sufficient coal available at night to meet the peak demand. And that changes, again, our maintenance plan. So between those three big events, what we have seen is a more volatile performance of our current power stations because, to a great extent, we had to use that space to move their maintenance out. So those are the unpredictabilities, Chair, that you referred to. And the reason why we would want to have a situation where we meet the demand and have a reserve is to deal with unpredictabilities, such as this. Now, when we say Kuba comes out for 900 megawatts, it's not just 900 megawatts, because we transport power to the Cape. So it's 900 megawatts plus all the losses that we suffered. So it's really two big coal units for one Kubuk unit, or two big coal units for one Kubabasa. And that is really the impact that we then see on the power system. We have flipped the light on in the summer. We've used extensive use of open cycle gas turbines down in the Cape. We have used demand-side measures, and I'll take them committee through that. But we also have reduced our planned maintenance, because those units had to go on oxygen, had to be shifted to keep the light on. We usually reduce our maintenance to a minimum in winter, but this winter will be different. There's some planned maintenance that we just cannot defer, and we will not put our plant safety at risk, because that's not in the interest of Eskom or the country. But very importantly, during winter evenings, our demand can jump by up to 3,000 megawatts within 1 hour. And that 3,000 megawatts is equivalent to most of our neighboring countries' electricity demand combined. And that's really what we're urging South Africans to work on. It's a peak demand. We think we can beat that peak, and it's very important. If we switch our non-essential suppliers for those 4 hours, it's absolutely doable to reduce the peak demand. We have certainly reached the point where we cannot continue to defer generation maintenance any longer. I think I've said that. The performance of our own fleet is becoming more volatile as you do less maintenance. And I must say that we're concerned about the Kabarabata scheme. Mungezi, the head of our transmission and head of system operations, he's been intensely engaged with them, and he can also give a sense of where we are. But going into the winter, we are concerned about the liability, and I'll show the committee that later. A multi-year plant application, and the determination has now been made, has added to the challenges in managing a very tight system because it reduces our ability in terms of for us to procure measures to manage demand and to manage supply. Within the determination, we have applied money to really deal with the demand-side measures. That is, Eskom has been rolling out. We've been rolling out solar water heaters. We've been running energy-efficient lighting. We've done many things today in South Africa that were not there 5 years ago. All of that has been rolled out. Now, that must be done by somebody. And from our perspective, the demand side management is a very important part of our managing the power system. And obviously on the supply side, the application has not allowed for any further investment in power generation beyond what's currently in the plans. And that's something the country must deal with. We will implement our generation fleet strategy that's based on 80% availability from our coal fleet and our nuclear fleet, an average across all of them, an average of 10% planned maintenance and an average of 10% unplanned outages over the next 5 years. We believe that gives us a balance to maintain the fleet. It is not ideally what we would want it to have. We obviously would want it to have high levels of planned maintenance, but we just cannot do that with the capacity in the country. But it also would allow us to start meeting our environmental requirements, particularly on emissions, where we're really struggling with particularly coal qualities. Much of our planned maintenance will be fixed. So once we have scheduled the market, we would fix it, not change it. And then from that perspective, it provides us certainty in terms of the planning and making sure that we comply with the requirements that we have. But it's very important that the country must explore additional supply side options. We for now have contracting every supply option that is available both within the country and most of what's available in our neighboring countries that we can get here. And we must explore the demand side options in the medium term. The demand side benefits in South Africa are significant for the country. It's not just a benefit for the power system, it's a climate benefit, it's a carbon benefit, and certainly benefit customers in terms of electricity bills as well. If we review the quarter that has passed, we have maintained our planned maintenance. On average, we would like to do 10%. So during winters, normally it's a lot lower. But our existing fleet has experienced increased unplanned unavailability, and it started in July last year, particularly when we had to reduce Korobasa and the Kubuk length that we have experienced over the last summer months. So the power station's performance has become more volatile, and for us it's very important that we reduce the unplanned outages to the deadline, and that is what the team is working on. We have used the open-type gas turbines increasingly, more than what we've done in previous years, with currently running that at an average load factor of 20%. Across our open cycle gas turbines, and we use that to create a space to do maintenance and to meet the energy requirements within the country. The Borobasta availability on the next slide then gives you a very clear indication that since July 2012 we've had quite simply poor performance, and it's a big part of the energy supply. It would be, from an Eskom perspective, the largest unit of power that we have. The second largest would be Kubuk. And this is, as I've indicated, due to the loss of the smoothing reactor. That has been returned in November. Then we had the floods, and that has been returned, as I've indicated, yesterday morning. We obviously were monitoring the performance of the water buffer. We have experienced days where we lost all of the supply, and that certainly becomes quite a big unpredictability for us during the day when we then have to deal with that. If you look at our coal stocks, despite all the issues that we had in terms of strikes within the coal mines, we have healthy coal stocks. We have currently at 47 days. We are in a totally different position than in 2008, when we had the events on the power system. The coal stocks had peaked at 49 days, and then we had the impact of the Zara strikes at Matla, at Arnott, and at Matimba power stations. And that's where we reduced loads, and our capacity has been reduced by as much as 1,000 megawatts that I've indicated during the day to conserve the coal stockpiles and make sure that there are no coal. But the coal stockpile, as we stand now, is healthy. The integrated demand savings in South Africa, we certainly have within the country one of the, I would say, one of the largest demand-side management programs that is being run by any utility. Within MIPD2, our previous price application, we were given targets, and you can see the targets for each year. And by the end of March, which we've just finished our financial year, Eskom would have achieved 123% of the demand side savings target. So that's 1,270 megawatts that has been saved within the customer base, throughout the customer base. That has come from essentially the residential sector. This is where we applied the funds from the regulator too. It's come from our commercial and corporates, where we invest significantly in energy efficiency. Large industry and mining, where we invest in the changing of pumps, motors, fans, compressors. The solar water heater program, as well as agriculture. So that's where the savings have been achieved. But since we started this as a country in 2005, we have, through this process, have resulted in over 3,500 megawatts of savings in terms of demand within the country. And that is, we sit back, that is about the size of a typical big power station. And that gives you the sense of the importance of the demand by program. And this is certainly the cheapest capacity that we can find within the country. Our residential program that is run across the residential sectors, and I again must note that Eskom supplies a very small portion of African residents. We have the power of messages that we put on television. People do respond to that, customers respond to that. When we put that on average, we see a 300 megawatt reduction. People actually standing up and taking action. During the summer months, and sometimes quite higher within winter. We have an incidental mass rollout program that we've been busy with. Phase one has been completed. That yield is 218 megawatts. We have at the same time made sure that we visit households, that we create jobs in making sure people go around changing light bulbs and doing many things. And the phase two of this program has been launched last year. We had a savings target of 80 megawatts. Certainly going forward, this is where we are really starting to assess the impact of price application, whether or not we have funds to continue with many of these programs going forward. The water heat pump rebate program continues to go, similarly with obviously the solar water heat installation within the country. So this winter, if we then turn to this winter, and within winter we have I think different load profile than in summer months. In summer, our loads are pretty flat. In winter, we have, over a typical week, we have quite a high peak between just before 5 o'clock to about 7 o'clock every evening. And as I've indicated, this demand can spike by more than 3,000 megawatts during the evening peaks. And that is equivalent, as we've indicated, to about 5 of our large units, which makes quite a big difference. And that is driven, the winter hour dynamic is primarily driven by residential customers. There's no fault of customers. It is actually the result of electrifying 84% of South Africans. That's what we've been doing. And it's now about how do we change behavior in many of those specific areas. So the outlook for this winter, water buster is expected to return to 1,300 megawatts. That was achieved yesterday, so as of today, we do have 1,300 megawatts. The final 200 that is due to Eskom will only be done in the third quarter of this year. Kubik is expected to come back mid-April. Kubik has returned yesterday and is busy today loading up to full load. The planned maintenance over the winter period, that will be different for us. It will be approximately 2,000 megawatts. And as indicated, cannot delay this any further. We have an intense focus on reducing our unplanned outages and keep that below our target level of 4,500 megawatts. Our peak winter forecast for this year, and that gives you some indication of what's happening to demand, is 36,800 megawatts. That is likely lower than last year. Our electricity sales year to date indicates that we have experienced lower electricity sales than last year. I think there's quite a few factors that have impacted that. Certainly the demand side programs that we've been having, slow growth in the economy, as well as the industrial actions that we've had this year across the whole sector. So the peak demand is slightly lower than last year, but that is an average of 1 hour. So the higher demand, one night, 1 hour in winter. But within that hour, we experience instantaneous demand that can actually grow as fast as 38,000 megawatts. And that is really what we have to then make sure we keep our plant available. So we keep all our stations available during the day. They may not run full load. They actually do not run full load. And at night, we actually also have to reduce the load because we've got too much energy just for the 1 hour when we need that at night. And the reason why we would want to look at the peak demand is that we can then use the rest of the day to do the maintenance and the evening to actually take that plant out and maintain it, then to supply the load if customers can have an intervention. We have supply and demand side levers in place, and I'll take you through that. And as we've indicated, the tariff decision obviously impacts that. We must remember, whatever we indicate to you as what we have available on top of that, in addition to our contingencies and deal with some of the unpredictability that the chair has raised, we have 2,100 megawatts available of interruptible load that's available to us for up to 2 hours a week. And that is from the bulletin aluminium smelters. That's part of the contract. That is what we do not pay them for. So we keep that available to make sure we can deal with managing the frequency within the power system. So after all the capacity that we've indicated, we still have above that 2,100 megawatts available interruptible load. Then what are the levers? What are those options that we do have? Some expire before this winter, and others have been extended to December. And we have contracted in municipal generation. You can see how much we've actually targeted and how much we've actually contracted and how much is actually operational. So that is in Tshwane, that is in City Power. Four IPPs are currently generating and contracted. We have non-ESCOM competing power that's available. Some of our Munich is available. I think the city has some available that we have. And we have the power buyback program that comes to an end by the end of May that we've been using, not to meet the peak demand, but really to make sure we have enough space to meet. And that is, and I'll go through that in a bit more detail. On demand side, our demand response rewards programs, we can see the megawatt indicator there. We don't have anything in terms of a mandatory energy conservation scheme. There's some residential demand management programs that are being rolled out, as well as supplemental demand market participation, where over peak period, customers are available for us to buy back the capacity. If I stop at the power buyback, Eskom and our large customers, mainly within Ferrochrome and Ferroalloys, have entered into an agreement that has been voluntary. And we have not forced anybody, voluntary, for mutual benefit. The customers felt that commodity prices then were too low to operate. And we found it beneficial to buy back the power. It's up to only 1,000 megawatts that has been available. And the commitment was not to compromise their contractual commitment on customer side, nor for them to incur any job losses. That is contractually stated that they should not incur any job losses. We have used the space to do the maintenance that it's made available to us. This will come to an end in May. It started in November 2012. It will come to an end next month. We will most probably not proceed with it any longer because certainly from our perspective, we do not have the resources for that. And I must state to the committee that we have, within our price application, have not applied. We have not applied in NYPD3 for 8 billion rand for power buybacks. It's never in our application. We've not applied for it. We've only applied for demand market participation for peak periods, and we've only applied for demand side management initiatives for energy efficiency. The winter tariffs is a very important issue for us. The reason why we finish at the end of May, and we've never had the power buyback contract in the winter, and the reason why that is, this is last customer. In terms of the regulator's tariffs, the tariffs between summer and tariff that they pay in winter, it's 8 times more. So naturally within South Africa, large customers within winter actually do their maintenance. So when we do our maintenance in summer, they do theirs in winter when we have high electricity tariffs. And that is to disincentivize customers at high peak periods not to use electricity. And customers resorted to then do maintenance in winter. So what many times happens is as our power buyback comes to an end, as we lead into winter, customer capacity remains down. And it's not contract of Eskom, it's just their own maintenance that they continue to perform across the customer base. So we certainly every year see a reduction in demand as winter tariffs then kick in for customers. This picture on the next slide is what we provide every quarter. This is our system for the power system for winter. And as you can see, it represents every week. It represents our assumptions on unplanned outages, planned outages, and the forecast for demand. And really, if you look at each of the boxes, it indicates 1 hour, not the full day or the week, just 1 hour, the highest peak demand within that week. Obviously, our objective would have to have that green. So the Mangezi's perspective as a system operator, he would want to meet the capacity, the demand in the country, and he would want to have the reserves of 2,000 megawatts to make sure if something happens, he's got reserves. And really, the red and yellow indicates that our reserves are depleted because we're doing a higher maintenance as well. And we would obviously ideally want that to be going from a planning perspective, be green from that perspective. That would indicate that we have adequate capacity to meet the demand. So this winter we will be able to meet the demand. The question is, can we meet the demand and have sufficient reserves available to deal for any unpredictable events that's coming up? And hence we have indicated some time ago, as I've said, that the country does need an energy conservation scheme to make sure that we protect the power system. And yesterday I commented quite extensively as to what is our system operator's primary mandate. And there's a distinction between the events that we've seen in 2008 around interruption of supply at a customer level. There's a distinction between that and a full blackout of electricity in the country. And our primary mandate is to make sure the country never gets there. The committee will recall the events you've seen in other parts of the world, in India, you've seen some in the US. Our primary mandate is to make sure we will never get to that point. Because to restore the power system from there, where the whole of the country don't have electricity, would be quite a challenge. We test it, we have ways of dealing with it, we've got procedures to deal with it, and to a great extent, we actually simulate it and exercise it. Our primary objective is to make sure the country never gets to that point. And from that perspective, certainly we would make sure we always, at all times, will balance supply and demand. And if there's not enough supply, we will reduce the demand to make sure that the two things are balanced. But our primary objective would never be to get there. So this is the outlook then for wind. So how can we deal with this, making sure we can beat the peak? So we're talking about 4 hours. And if we think about very simple steps that all of us can take as customers to reduce the electricity demand between those 4 hours, if we switch off all the geysers and all pool pumps, you will have enough hot water. We don't need bright blue swimming pools. Actually, we'll still say bright blue. Run them at night. Run them between 10 o'clock and 4 o'clock every morning. Switch off all non-essential lighting. And then, across our customer base, we all, when it gets cold, go buy an electrical heater. And certainly, we have to find alternatives towards how do we deal with space heating and then respond to our power that is needed on television. I think those are very simple steps. Customers can switch to energy efficient technologies, take advantage of energy swapping. It would change water heating from electricity to solar. That makes a big difference. We have many of these rebates available, and many of that is within the market. If I then just look at how we then have thought through our generation fleet for the next 5 years, fact is that our power stations are aging. They do need increased focus to maintain them and improve their performance. We often have to shift the maintenance to deal with unpredictable events and make sure we meet the capacity and the demand in the country and keep our lights on. So that would not be sustainable going forward. We have done quite a high level of maintenance up to now. We would like to do a lot more and have it predictable, really. And it's essential for us that we do a planned maintenance in making sure the whole power system remains sustainable. We have put together a 5-year plan that includes pretty firm commitments for us that once we plan, we would then execute our maintenance and not just that. And then implementing this will allow us certainly better resource planning and a more effective utilization of our partners that has to execute this work. If we look at our fleet of power stations, 64% of them are past the midlife. So the past midlife crisis, it's an issue that Chairman Gutierrez is alluding to. What the country needs to do, we must think about this. We have a massive electricity system in the country. And I must say, transmission lines are about the same age, 30, 40 years in the country. Distribution networks is about the same age, not only in Eskom, but in municipalities. And so this needs to be very important that the country maintains that and that the country makes sure it invests in its refurbishment and replacement going forward. And so it's very important because of this, the power stations need increased maintenance. And what we would like to achieve, ideally, would be as we take maintenance, we do our major projects, we extend the life of many of our stations and implement our environmental measures, where we put new equipment in to limit our emissions or reduce our water. We would like to do a design-based maintenance philosophy, where many times we shut the station down and inspect it, in order to make sure we can assure, of course, integrity. And it's very important that we do that on a regular basis. We obviously will not compromise our statutory and safety maintenance, and there will be continuous emergent work that will come along. And so as we can look at on the right-hand side, ideally, currently, we're doing design-based maintenance around 2.2%. That we would want to have a lot higher, and most will be a lot closer to 6% of the time. We really have our plant up on a routine basis to deal with maintenance. So with the constraint capacity, our maintenance person ability to execute, really there are 4 primary technical drivers that exist in defining for us a sustainable path.
obviously the supply-demand relationship and how flexible that is. How do we make sure we clear the backlog of maintenance? We have reduced the maintenance backlog that we've had. We started with 36, we're now 23, and we keep on working to clear many of the backlog that we have. We obviously prioritize the maintenance in terms of what we actually have to do over the life of the stations, and make sure we target the overall health of the fleet. We do prioritize some of our stations, you know, bigger stations first, our newer stations first, that does impact some of our older stations as to how much life they have. So the older the station, we may not maintain it as intensely because it's getting to the end of its life, and provide all the time and resources to our newer fleet. So the strategy that we've then settled on is that for the next 5 years, in order to get to a sustainable fleet of our current fleet delivering 8% of availability, 10% and RTPs on a fixed basis, and then would expect a 4% or 10% unplanned RTP trade. But about 8% of this will be made, as I said, on fixed basis, so at least we have certainty, and have 2% of the 10% available for more short-term outages. And that's very important for us to create really a predictable performance out of the existing fleet. We have to continue to improve our unplanned outages, and as that improves, it gets better than 10%, we would use that for maintenance, actually, as we've been able to do that. But for this winter, we have a minimum, as I've indicated, of 9 units that we certainly we cannot reschedule this outage to after this winter. We for this winter, will have to go through this winter with being that long-term maintenance. Chairman, just to wrap up this and conclude, the power system has been constrained, and we have communicated this consistently, and I think we have managed it very well over the last few years. And it has been in this past summer very constrained, been very tight because of the reduced imports that we've received and the unplanned outages, including the Kuba Gin 1 units. And this has meant that we sucked up the space that we had available to do maintenance. All plans that we set for the summer, a lot of that had to be changed. So going into the winter, for the first time, we're doing some extensive maintenance work, making it different, certainly for the winter, and even during the colder months this year, we will be doing that maintenance. Chairman, in the discussed last year, we've given you an indication of how we prepare for winter, including not just on generation side, that's what we've been talking about, but also on our transmission side. You know that last year we've had many events of snow in the country, so we've already started with our contingency plans, making sure people are out there to deal with severe weather events. What we are seeing in the country is that the weather events, both in summer and in winter, is very intense. The snow is harder, it's a lot colder for very short periods of time. This summer we've seen lots of lightning strikes that has actually impacted some of the power stations, but we have started preparing for that. We urge customers that together with their support, particularly over those 4 hours, we can reduce the peak demand, and if we do that, we'll certainly ensure that the light stays on and we have a secure power system. And really we're talking about, if you think about 10% of everybody's electricity use, that's up 3,000 megawatts, that certainly would do it. We have that comprehensive review of what we need to do around our maintenance to ensure that the power stations are more sustainable, that is completed. We have put initiatives in place to deal with supply and demand measures. We have spoken about the impact of actually our ability to execute that, because somebody will have to do that, if not us. The country needs a safety net. We have, as Eskom, developed this, provided this, put it forward. It needs a safety net to make sure there's a greater sense of predictability than in many countries. Think back at what happened in Japan when they had to shut down the nuclear plant, how they've implemented the energy conservation scheme in that country. Brazil has done the same. Many others have done the same. When they have, and we do it as a country when we have a drought. We conserve water. We have a very clear conservation scheme around water. And that's what we're having now, as far as electricity is concerned. We have, and we continue to remain, Chairman, determined to keep the light on. We've always said that we can't do it alone. We really need to partner with yourselves, and many of you have been very supportive in your conclusions, in your constituencies, but we really need support of Africans to make sure that we're safe. But as an Eskom team, not just the people sitting here, but many thousands across the country are fully committed to make sure that we keep powering
the country. Chimina, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dalmas. Members, do you have it's a very comprehensive presentation in a few slides. But thank you for making it quite clear what are the issues on the table. I'm going to open it up for questions. Can I appeal to members to be to the point, to ask your question directly, and if you go beyond three questions, I may want to allow you one more, but beyond that, no. So be to the point and really ask either clarity or a specific question. And it's Honorable Marie, Honorable Michael, Honorable Chris Gololo, Honorable Okwena, Honorable September, Honorable Forman, and Honorable Nana, and Honorable Rose Sotu. Your answer is not there yet. You can continue.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will be to the point. To summarize, in one sentence, if the power supply from Kuberg and Kiribati would be cut off to South Africa, we're in very, very serious trouble. So I just want to hear from a long-term view from the CEO, what is his view on having a second nuclear plant in South Africa and the time limit to it? Because we have to secure in that way more sustainability in that form. My second question would be, in more in line of resources and that is cash flow question, do the CEO at this point in time, can you give me an indication of what is being owed to Eskom in the form of payment for electricity by the various municipalities in South Africa over 30 days? What has been owed to him? And then I will just...
Thank you. Honorable Michael.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Dalmas just told us that this winter, for the first time, the maintenance will be on a huge scale. Why? What is the reason for this massive maintenance backlog? What caused this backlog, and why do we now sit with a situation where we have to maintain our power stations at the beginning and during winter? Also, we heard that Minister Gigaba paid a visit to the Magufi power station, and Mr. Dalmas is telling us that under no circumstances are any backlogs allowed. What penalties, Chairperson, are going to be implemented at the Medupi power station to ensure that there are no longer backlogs and problems at the station and that the station is completed on time? Chair, we heard from Mr. Dalmas that Billiton, according to their contract, is 2 hours where they have to give back electricity. Chair, when last did we buy back power from Billiton and Ferrochrome, and what is the cost to Eskom every time we have to do this? And Chair, in line with Billiton, how far is Eskom in renegotiating the contract regarding the pricing that Billiton gets? And then Chair, finally, my last question. Chair, Mr. Dalmas released a statement yesterday, and I quote, he said, "We will take whatever measures we need. It means we get close, we will drop the load, we will drop customers and protect the country." Chair, certainly when you make a comment like we will drop customers and protect the country, that doesn't really inspire investors to invest in a country so they know that they could be dropped. So I just want to know clarity on that particular statement.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me thank the CEO for the presentation. I've got three and one comment on this. The first one, actually, the comment. Let me start with the comment that saving electricity, I think, should begin with us, especially here in this room, because right now I'm having flu and I feel very, very cold. I think we need to switch off that air
conditioning. Nothing to do with this, but I'm thinking.
Yeah, it's saving electricity at the end of the day. And then the first question, actually, will be on the, I just want to check with the means of communication that you are employing in putting the message across to all consumers about the use of electricity sparingly. That would be the first one. The second one actually would be on the maintenance chair, in that for the very, very first time, you will be doing your maintenance now in winter. And the power outages that we are going to be experiencing this winter will be due to the maintenance. That's how I interpret it. Is that the message that you put in a house on the power outages that we're going to experience that this winter Is it because of the maintenance? That was the second one. The first one was comment. Now, the last one. The point of clarity here that I wanted to find out from ESCOM, because it's a confusion out there. I think most of us should benefit from this answer from ESCOM. It is often said that if you want to save electricity in your own home, you need to switch off the geyser. When you want to use the geyser, you need to switch it on. Which one is best, actually? Do you leave your geyser to be on continuously, or you switch it on and off, on and off? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable. Honorable,
thank you, Chairperson. I want to associate myself with the complimentary remarks echoed by my colleagues. Three quick questions. And I hope I want to presage them with the statement that we are very, very proud of ESCOM as a state-owned company. They've never let us down, particularly in the World Cup, the 2010 World Cup, which was preceded by blackouts or power outages. And, you know, we are very, very sensitive to the fact that we could actually disappoint the world. But ESCOM has put through very, very multiple. And I think with the assurances that we have now from ESCOM, we think we'll put through. And we appreciate and welcome the encyclopedic presentation this morning. Three quick questions. Number one, the personal one. Ms. Davis, there was a rumor that you, the CEO of the ESCOM, can you categorically dispel, you know, that statement now? Or confirm? Because...
Let me explain. You asked the question.
Yeah, the assurances are very impressive. But different things are going to make assurance, like you've done, in the chair. And another one will make assurance when the door is ajar. Number one. Number two. There are four intermediate concepts, and I'm a layperson, not the electrical engineer. Blackouts, number one. Number two, load shedding, number three. Outages, number four, which you mentioned now recently is fracking a little bit. It's mass holding outages. You could just explain to us how they're related. The last one, Chairperson, quickly. What is the state of play as far as the green energy is concerned and the threat of its contribution? We know it's still an inchoate new effort, but just as you know, it might be an academic question at this stage because we're facing reality, but just as you know, how far are we in terms of together with the preparations to have nuclear energy?
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you to the CEO for the presentation here today. But more than that, I think we must thank ESCOM for facing the country. Despite whatever else that they have been doing for quite a couple of weeks now to face the country and say this is the issue, whether they are bad or good and so on, I think it's the right approach to tell the country when there are problems, and not just to say to the country we are doing well. But thank you for placing the national interest of the country first in the statement that we have made yesterday. We think that it's important that you continue to give hope to the people and say if there are problems with other things that you are prepared to do. That's an absolute statement of protecting the national interest of the country. Okay, I want to find out, by when would you consider legislation that would back up your quest of ensuring that everyone is on board with regard to, in particular, conservation? What I would say, a legislation that would speak to ensuring that South Africa becomes a way of life instead of the ad hoc approach that we are having at the moment. If you take away all the adverse and all of that thing, we are all human beings. We'll just go back to normal. And so I think that we are not instilling a sense of it must be a way of life of how we do that. I'd like to ask in that same breath, what data can you provide for us that government institutions are leading in this way of life? Let's take Parliament. How many of us are you convinced switches off the light when we leave our rooms? How many of us in this, wherever in Parliament, and there are very many people that occupy offices here, including the media occupy offices here in Parliament, how many of them can you say via public work are and have made a way of life by ensuring that these are the things that we are doing? I do not support an ad hoc program. I support a plan that is consistent as a way of life, I say, and a plan that that ensures that it's a sustainable one. And so, Jay, I'd really like to know, and what are the components of that? So I'd really like to know, if I don't many departments, but I'd love to hear in this meeting what the statistics and the data are, because if we don't lead, we can't go out there to go and ask everyone else to lead. The other thing that I want to suggest, if I look at your pizza peak, if I go through it, suggest it's a particular category of people in the country which you are speaking to. In your global, they don't have pool that you are appealing to. I think we've got to be a little bit more bold to say to a particular category of people, it is us that are causing some of these problems because we have bigger houses and we use particular things. So I think the message is wrong to ask people to switch off pools when the vast majority of people don't have pools. We must bring the problem closer to where it is. I see that in your pizza peak, you are asking for water bottles and so on. Doesn't that cause a bit of a problem with couples when you want to put something else in between the water bottle? Thank you, Jesse.
Mr. Trimmer, is that your last question? This is your question.
The last one is really just a committee. We have been appealing to ESCOM to use members of Parliament in this entire program. We have yet to receive in our different constituencies making available the different, whatever you are. I think it's important we are all pigeonholes, other than people flooding us with all sorts of facilities. Our pigeonholes should have been flooded by now, so let's take these things to our constituencies. We are your ambassadors out there, and I don't think ESCOM is rising to this quest. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks. Honourable Palmer.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to also say that I'm very pleased that you are putting the facts in front of us, where you could really have try to manage this quietly by yourself, although it would eventually come up. And then to say, just to lead on from what the Honourable September said about the visitors and the conserving of energy, it was quite interesting because as part of the committee, the AC component of the committee, we wrote to all the ministers and asked them how much they were saying in their departments on electricity, and we had a comeback of the 50 some of about 6 replies out of the 34 that went out, and I think that's not a very good indictment. So I just want to remind us about that fact, and I was thinking about it this morning and I was preparing for this. And then to say, perhaps on a lighter note, just to pick up on the air conditioning that has been referred to, it was quite interesting this morning, the two presenters, I don't know how many people listen to SAFM, but Mandla comes to work in a blanket because the air conditioning in his car gives him flu. And so between him and Kalani this morning, they discussed whether, in fact, that is a good idea because apparently the cops stopped him and wanted to know whether he was wearing pants because his rep
going out and search. But anyway, yes, you know, some of these things. And I think your quite apart from that, your campaign certainly has showed, you know, how people have responded to that. However, I think my question at the end, the road here, would be somewhat a little bit different, to say that it concerns me that the committee with its oversight role and the many oversight bodies, you know, watching the whole situation can still fall flat on their face at the end of the day. I think at the thought of the thing is going to do be coming online. And I think my question would be, and now we do see that there is an intensified effort being made to make sure that things are going to come right. And the question I would have is, why have we left that so late to intensify? There must have been some way in which we had some indication that the wheels would start falling off. And then perhaps my second question would be around the solar water heaters that you have mentioned. And I think of the million that was targeted, there's about a third or 400, 1,000, something like that. It's been a very small uptake in relation to what the target was. And, you know, obviously the cost must be part of that, but perhaps you could indicate to us why the uptake on the solar water heaters has been so small. And then let me just ask my third question, and that is relating to the coal, and I know we're going to be dealing with that shortly, but in view of the risks, and I know you've increased your reserves from 10 days to 46, 47 days, in view of the risks, do you think that needs to be increased even more to give you certainty of supply?
Thank you. One more moment. Nick? Mr. Nana?
Thanks, Chairperson, and sorry for coming late. Chair, firstly, let me commend Mr. Damas and his team for a communication tender that is wonderfully rolled out. There's nothing frustrating than trying to scrape for information and at the end of the day, if it's not forthcoming, we will be justified when we make our own opinions on the issue. Up to so far, job well done. You hardly skip a day, you have something coming out of Eskom, clarifying issues, explaining the status quo, and continuously assuring South Africans that despite all the difficulties, we'll still have energy throughout winter. But having said that, in the presentation that was prepared, and Honorable Connie September tried to get closer to my point by raising an issue about that not everyone has a swimming pool, not everyone has got two geysers at home, and many other things like are consuming electricity. A fraction of South Africans have got two geysers like this gentleman because he's got a big house. He's got a swimming pool pump because he's got a swimming pool at home.
What is your question?
I'm getting to a question.
I can see that.
I'm getting to a question. But what in my view, I think Mr. Damas is falling short of actually getting to the point. If domestic consumers in South Africa are consuming less than 20% of our national grid, and when there are problems with usage behavior, the very people who are consuming less are called to act differently. The truth of the matter is that you have your big industrial consumers
what is the situation with them? Is the message that is drilled home to us, is it the same message that they are receiving, that they must act differently? Because quite frankly, we are consuming far, far, far less of National Grid. The third question, Chair, is, Honorable Michael did touch on it. Back home in Alice, municipal workers every evening, of course they say that cleaning, if they do, it's another debate, they're saying that cleaning the streets every evening, they do that in the evening because during the day, the town is busy. There is no time to clean. They can never do any job that would be clean just in the town. And I don't get it. As I was driving to work this morning, I was thinking about the rationale behind doing maintenance in winter and in night during what Mr. Damien calls peak hour. Why do you conduct your maintenance in winter and at night? I might be wrong, but I'm beginning to suspect could it be a question of Eskom trying to hit back at consumers for having objected to their interest, that they are now all of a sudden conducting this routine maintenance in winter and during peak hour. The third one, check before you get out of patience, I can see.
No, you, in
injury
time.
Oh, okay. Chair, slide number 19 again. Mr. Damas mentioned that they have this budget program. Again, Honorable Michael has spoken on it. But I'd like to expand on it a bit, Chair. It's common knowledge that smelters in this country and some across the borders of our country are getting electricity for close to nothing. And it would be very interesting to know from Eskom that how much are they buying back, knowing that these smelters are getting the energy for close to nothing in any case. How much are they buying it back from? Are the smelters making profit, or are they getting it at cost and so on and so on?
Thank you. You made your point, Honorable Salton.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Thank you to the CEO that is widely rumored to be packing his bag. And I'm sure we'll get a confirmation or something else today from you, CEO. CEO, I think your strategy of informing the public about how they should save electricity is quite a good one. But my question would be, how emphatic are you to the big electricity users, factories, mines, and the like? What is it that you do differently between me, who is using very little electricity, that's a line that comes to me, and they are using volume? Secondly, I was part of a meeting last weekend that was saying Eskom is taking from the poor to subsidize the rich. That was referring to your tariff hikes. And the BHP bulletin was a case in point. What does Eskom say on that one?
The last one, Chairperson. No, let me leave it. Let me leave it. Thank you very much.
Just before I hand over to Mr. Thomas, from my side, you say we are the plan, the 10%, the 80-10-10, that 10% unplanned maintenance or unplanned outages is you will want to keep below or less than 4,500 megawatt during this winter. Can you just explain to the committee how and when and who will do that? And have we costed that? If I remember correctly, that's about the size of a power plant. To keep that below 4,500, have we cost? What the effect will be on the economy to do unplanned maintenance? Secondly, just for maybe I don't understand it, but just if you say we are going to close 9 units throughout this winter period or maintain maintenance for the unit, what does that entail? Is this a unit that you close down during after hours? Do you close it for extended periods of time? Do you close it for a number of days, a number of hours? Just explain to Parliament what does that entail for the winter period of closing down 9 units or maintaining 9 units? I want to use the correct terminology. And lastly, just my question that I ask in the up front is, if we say the plant midlife has passed of many of our plants, what is the future in that? How do we go beyond 2017 when the last unit, I think, of, is it Kusile, coming, or the last unit of Kusile coming out? How do we start to plan for the future, for the next generation, for the next couple of years? I need you to express and inform us. Just give us a glimpse of your vision, Eskom's vision. How do we want to go in the future and longer term in terms of more power stations, of more energy generation initiatives, that we don't only focus on the short winter period and immediate future? Mr. Thomas, over to you. And you're most welcome to use some of your other colleagues to... We don't want fruitless expenditure so for people flying down from Pretoria to come and sit here and not participate. There was one personal question. Allowed it, it's fine, but it's for you, up to you to make a call on it.
Chairman and committee member, thank you. My team will certainly assist, and I will ask that they please clarify, and I think what we suggest we do is lots of questions. We will deal with them from the beginning, one by one, and if the committee is okay with that. The question that Honourable Michael raised is really the impact of Kabora Basa at Coburg on the power system. And the reason why the impact are quite emphasized is because of the size. Coburg is one unit of 900 and in the West Bukit, so it's far, and Kabora Basa is just 1,500 megawatts. So yes, certainly in the long term it's very important that they're reliable and they're stable. And we have offered on the government side to even invest in helping upgrading the equipment. The process has started. It is investing in upgrading their substation. They will run that in Mozambique. And Mongezi, can I ask him just to add a little bit about that? The future of nuclear, I think that was a question. We believe certainly that Africa needs to proceed with the nuclear playing an option in the country. It is baseload capacity. If we think about the country, we have most of our coal resources in the north of the country. We have a lot of our demand in the coastal areas where we have no other options of supply. And then the second big issue would be around water. I think the future for us and how we look at the future energy choices in South Africa, water has to play a bigger role. So you see us building Medupi and Kusile dry cool, that's the biggest dry cool. Because of nuclear, it's located at the coast, certainly it also deals with that. So you asked a question around the timeline. We have an integrated resource plan as a country. We have one. We've announced it in 2010. And it really looks at how do we balance all of these supply options, including nuclear. And from our perspective, that plan has indicated that nuclear unit should be operational, I believe, I can call 2023 or something like that. But we certainly believe that the decision around this is necessary and needs to be done as soon as possible. These stations, whether nuclear or coal, you need to make sure you have a long-term plan as a country and make the decision and plan up front and execute. I mean, if we think back as a country, we should not be here. If in 1998 we did what we were supposed to do, Medupi by now should have been finished, done, clocked. And if you leave this too late, we've seen, and similarly with nuclear, I think it's very important. So we have a plan as a country. We have to execute that plan. And that would be very important. We believe nuclear should play a role amongst many other technologies within South Africa. There was a question around the cash flow. If I don't have the exact number in terms of how much does municipalities owe us greater than 30 days, as of the end of March, if I can recall, the number greater than 30 days, and 30 days is current, is just over R1 billion. We have some key issues with municipalities, and they have addressed that. But we will find the exact number for you, and certainly when we present our results, we will give you that number. But by the end of March, we were just over R1 billion. So that's it. And Gizzy, do you want to add to that?
Cleo Chaperson, just to make a comment both on Kuberg and Karabasa. On Kuberg, one of the challenges as well is that it's, in fact, the whole of the Western Cape is some 1,500 kilometers from the cluster of power station. So even to bring the load, the power, from the Highveld, from the power stations to Cape Town, one incurs in the region of 200 megawatts or load losses alone. The second issue is that because of the line, you've got also the exposure of the power line. So anything could happen, either weather or equipment fail and so on. So for us, Kuberg, both from a load size point of view, but from a risk point of view, is very important from the security of supply. Similar to Karabasa. Karabasa, probably two things that come to mind. One is the skills issue, because Karabasa is a high voltage, direct current, not AC current. And therefore, we've got specialized skills that actually maintain that. And those are not common across the country. And in particular, not very common in Mozambique. And therefore, you get a very slow response to issues and failures when they happen. Control to control, we talk to them because we operate the same scheme. But when it comes to skills, it's another country. There's protocols, there's processes, and sometimes that process takes a bit longer. So that's the first thing. The second one is the lines, again, from Songo, which is right on the north of Mozambique, down to Johannesburg. That's over 2,000 kilometers. Again, the exposure of the line, the clearances, when the power line was flooded and the towers fell, which only came back yesterday. There was, for instance, a risk of demining the area, because with the floods and all the landmines that were in Mozambique previously, one fears that there could be movement of that, and therefore your approach in restoring that power is very carefully managed from a safety point of view. So there's a whole lot of exposure with that line coming from Mozambique. And lastly is the issue of the converter stations. When you convert from AC to DC, it's a very intensive process. There's a lot of heating and cooling, and there's a whole lot of failures that could happen. South Africa, we've refurbished our converter station in Apollo. But Mozambique, unfortunately, didn't refurbish at the same time, and find that their performance on the other side is not as good as the one on the South African side. So that comment on importance and criticality of both Kuberg in the Western Cape and then Mozambique in the North Chair. And then maybe that comment, Chair, is just the medium-term outlook. We basically wrote by the IRP 2010, which basically predicts that by 2030, what is a 20-year view, that South Africa should double their capacity to about 80,000 megawatts. This year, the OE has announced that they wish to revise the IRP 2010 to look at the effect of the slower growth in power demand, and maybe we'll see some revision on that. But basically, your IRP 2010 is your 20-year view that tells you which units and which generation mix, whether it's coal or renewable or nuclear or hydro, should come in at what year. And after the revision, that would be the current one.
Okay, so move to the question from Honourable Michaels. I think the first question is why maintenance in this winter? And the reason why this winter is different is because of extended maintenance. And starting to answer the chairman's question, that means that I'll teach on unit for quite a long time. And why it's been different is because in the summer, I think the events I've gone through, we've spoken about Cotabato, we've spoken about the Kubrick situation, that has impacted these units that had to go out for maintenance. So we could not do that. And we moved that. Now we can't move it any longer because it really starts putting the integrity of the plant at risk, and we can't do that. So we must do that now. And the reason why Kubrick, from a Kubrick perspective, we will always do the Kubrick outages or put Kubrick first as a priority within the planning, within ESCOM. It always takes us preference, whether they're outages or whether they're unplanned situations. In the case of Medupi, we have implemented the penalties and will continue to treat the contractors to the full letter of the law and make sure that they stick to that. And I'll come back to the question from Honourable Gorman on that as well. And really when I referred to the backlog, it was the backlog of maintenance, but it's very important that Medupi could see that gets built and that they get completed and that they certainly come and relieve the power system. And we will implement all our contractual remedies. So we have done that and we'll continue to do that with no discrimination amongst any of these contractors. If I can deal with the power buyback, we do not buy power back from BHP Billiton. So when we say Synoptis, Ferrochrome, it's really with BHP Billiton where we've renegotiated one contract and we have one special pricing agreement still in place that we've now submitted to the regulator. We do not buy power back from Billiton. So we don't pay them for power. The interruptible supply that is made available to us is already in those contracts and we pay nothing for that. It's part of the contract. So we can interrupt them in terms of the duration that I've indicated without any compensation to them. The buyback that we've been executing is up to 1,000 megawatts, as I've indicated. We set the price at a level similar to what it will cost us for us paying a private power generator produce electricity. So as I've indicated, those private power generators, the cost of new generation, we provide a similar price for customers for the 1,000 megawatts because that makes sense for us. So either you buy the capacity back or you buy the demand back. But we do not pay Billiton for, they're not part of the power buybacks and we don't bought any power back from them. Honorable, Michael referred to a statement I've made, or I think it's more correctly to say, a statement I've reported to make because it's not a NESCO statement. And I think I've tried to deal with that. And there was a question asked about the separation between load shedding and blackout. And my statement that the journalist unfortunately misquoted really dealt with the blackout situation. A blackout for us, and here I'm asking Mungesi again, you can add to that. A blackout would be when the total country loses all electricity. Total blackout in the country. And that is crucially important, and we will prevent that at all costs. Now, for us to do that, we have to manage supply and demand. So let's say, for instance, we don't have enough supply, we would have to reduce the demand because electricity can't be stored. We always have to keep these things in balance. If we have too much supply, like at night, we actually have too much supply, we should reduce the power station load. And that is what we will prevent. And it's something similar that we do. Many countries have done it. You know that India had 700 billion people out for a long time. We don't want to get to that position. We've not been there as ESCOM, and that's our first mandate, to never get there. When we refer to load shedding, and a couple of things that we had in 2008, the customers were interrupted for a certain period of time on a rotational basis to make sure that it's not a total blackout. So I think there's a distinction between that, and certainly my comments referred yesterday, particularly when I referred to blackout. So that is very important. I must say to you, to restore the country's electricity system from that situation will take a long time. And therefore, we don't even want to get there. And we will take whatever action we need to make sure we get there. And we've not been there. The last time South Africa was in a similar situation must have been the early 70s. But since then, and since we run this integrated power system, with transmission being part of it, we can able to actually manage the system and have successfully done this. You've seen blackouts in many parts of the U.S. You've not seen it in India. We've not had that type of situation within South Africa. And that is really what we're working towards.
Quickly, Chair, maybe we can actually answer one of the questions that was asking for the difference between outages, load shedding, and blackout.
starting with the localized outages. That's when local network is on default, and that's normal. We always try to have redundancy in our network. That's what we normally call N-1, so that if one equipment fails, you can still continue with your supply. But sometimes you've got radial network where there's only one equipment, and when it fails, then you've got interruption. So those are localized, and for winter, we try to do our maintenance upfront and make sure that we're ready to handle the winter as it comes. The second one may be easier is the blackout. The blackout, as the chief executive said, is when we lose all supply. And the generators are designed that when your frequency falls below a certain level, a certain threshold, those generators will automatically on themselves fall out of your integrated power system. And that will lead to a cascading effect where you actually lose total supply, as has happened in some of the international companies. And one of the mandates of national control is to ensure that we do not, you know, get to that end. Then there is then an in-between, which is the load shedding, as we call it. The load shedding is a deliberate reduction of load to actually address or stop the system from getting to the blackout. And there's a few things you do. First of all, in your system, you make sure that you've got reserves, so that if there's a machine that falls, you've got enough reserves to supply that shortage. And that's what we call operator reserve or emergency reserve. And then after that, you have certain other reserves, like your interruptibles, like the BHP contract, where you can, on contract, as agreed, actually drop load to actually control your load to match your supply. And those are normally for a short period of time, up to an hour, whereas your operating reserves are basically full-time as you operate. And then very last, as a safety net, you've got what we call under-frequency load sharing, where the system detects the frequency as it approaches the limit where you could slip to a blackout or more load reduction. It selectively opens certain breakers and isolates certain loads. We call it under-frequency load sharing. It's a self-protection system designed to actually protect the system from cascading to that. So those are the three schemes, and we've got protocols in terms of what do you use when what happens, what are the kind of levers you pull, either operating reserves, emergency reserves, interruptible loads, under-frequency load shedding, including voluntary reduction of some of our key customers, where we've got a relationship, and as we've got challenges, we call them, and you actually ask them to reduce the reserves. And lastly, there is a code by NERSA, the NRS 048-9, that actually also gives us the procedure of what to do when we actually hit problems in terms of power shortages. And that's what controls national control, or that's what regulates national control in terms of what action to take when what happens.
Yes, I move on to the questions asked by Honorable Hololo. I think the first one was around our communication messages and our means of communication. We have employed quite a lot of things. I mean, our power alert that we run on television is actually quite unique. Many countries have come to talk to us. Other utilities is about using something similar. So we're using social media very extensively. We have used very specific community radio stations. Each of our provinces, in the provinces, general managers actually go out there and make sure they communicate. But we've really tried to, over the last few years, extend our communication efforts. And I take up the point that we need to take the offer from a member of parliament to do this thing. The message for this winter is this winter is going to be different to other winters because we have to do this maintenance. We can't postpone any longer. Our intent is that we should keep a lifestyle. We think it is possible. We can't do it alone. Everybody must work with us. If everybody works with us, particularly over the peak period, we can make sure we can keep a lifestyle and do the maintenance we need to do. But it's very important that we do the maintenance. And I'll come back to that, because the maintenance will actually mean we take the unit off, and some of this is for a long time. Some of our outages can take 180 days. A short one will maybe take 40 days. So it's really the long, extensive outage. It's not about shutting it down and just getting it like a car by the end of the day. It's quite a bit of a work. And that's why the switch there would be different. The question was asked, is it better to switch on and off the geyser or just leave it on? It is better to switch the geyser off and then to switch it on when you need it. So if we imagine we go to work in the morning and we switch our geyser on, when we come back 4 o'clock, switch it off. We'll have hot water that evening. Switch it on again 10 o'clock at night. When we get up, we can switch it off. That's better. That takes, you have enough hot water. It's on during the night, you have hot water in the morning, on during the day, and you've seen the profile of the demand. So timers work very well, and if we really want to switch, then we switch the solar water geysers. Now we use a different energy source to really heat up water. So it's not good to leave geysers on. And we've had many questions. Do you use more power? Does it damage the geysers? No, it doesn't damage the geysers. And no, you don't use more power. Then the difficult, thank you for the compliment on the World Cup on Ramomokwena. And then you asked me a question. Eskom is crucially important for the country. There's not much that happens in Eskom truly powers South Africa. It's very important that Eskom, with its 40,000 people and 40,000 contractors, is stable, has got leadership in place that knows what they're doing and where they're working towards. We don't get it all right. I don't get it right. I'm fully committed to what I have to do and to lead Eskom. If that is what I'm asking. And I've got a team that is in place and they've been together for some time, and that is important. State-owned companies does play in South Africa and in many countries a very important role. And within South Africa, that is the priority we have to give to South Africa. And my commitment is to make sure that we do that. Then I think we have answered the question around blackouts, load shedding. I think Mongezi has dealt with that. Then there was a question on the state of play of green energy and its contribution. South Africa has decided in IRP 2010 that 42% of the additional capacity will be renewables, wind and solar. We have signed up with Eskom, now 2,400 megawatts of renewable energy that will produce 2% of the energy over the next 5 years. And I think the MRP application will give an indication of the cost. It will cost 2 rand or something like that, 2 rand per unit of electricity. So it will play a role. I know the private developers are out there busy starting construction. And certainly over the next 5 years, we will see that coming into the power system. But it will not solve necessarily the power issue. We need a combination of that, plus we need to build these big power stations that we now need and the ones that we need to replace the current ones. And that is the role of not just clean energy, but also the role of nuclear, and we believe gas, and I'll talk about that. Honorable September asked the question around the legislation, and maybe I can ask my colleagues from DPE to comment. From our perspective, we have developed and given a proposal around energy conservation. We have provided that to the department. I know that they're engaging with the policy department in this regard to make sure that we deal with that. But as a country, I think there's many other things we can do. Many other countries are looking at legislation for standards, equipment standards, more efficient equipment, holding standards. All of those things will make a difference. But for an energy conservation scheme, we have called for that. We've developed it. I know that public enterprise is engaging with the Department of Energy to take that forward in terms of the necessary legislation. I don't know if you want to comment.
Yeah, I can provide a short comment. There's two processes. The one is the energy efficiency policy, which the Department of Energy has actually proposed, and I think they're going to be rolling it out to ensure that the sustained behavior in terms of energy efficiency improvements. And the second one is around the safety net, the energy conservation scheme, and that dates back to when we had problems in 2008. And a lot of work has been done. You may recall that there was a lot of concerns and issues that were raised with the proposal that was put in place at the time. So the Department of Energy has been meeting around consolidating some of those comments and refining the rule to ensure that we were able to implement the energy conservation scheme and in that process then to finalize those rules. They have developed draft regulations to effect the rule, I think sometime last year, and again it's a process to refine those regulations and to ensure that the energy conservation scheme is able to be implemented. we're also looking at what other options are there. I mean, energy conservation scheme is just one of the measures that could be in place. So there is a proposal to look at what other measures can be put in place besides the energy conservation scheme. So there is a process of engaging with the Department of Energy as the policy leader in that regard.
There was a question around the department and government. Do we have data on what government departments do via public work? We have, we don't have any data. I know that the minister has been very active. He also, and companies have signed up to the 49M campaign. We have raised it, within public work. And I don't know if public enterprise may have data, but certainly from that side, we don't have any data. A lot can be done. A lot must be done, and we must lead. The category of customers and communication around that, I take the point. I think within our specific communication campaigns, we should look at how we categorize our messaging to different segments of customers. So we will look at that for this winter and going forward. And then I will ask the team to certainly provide the information to members of parliament for you to assist us in that communication. Chairman Honourable Gorman asked a question around setting the duty. We have, I think we could have intensified, particularly around the labour issues, our involvement of Australia. We lost 10 weeks on a dispute between workers of contractors and the contractors. You know, none of them are Eskom workers. I think stepping in, we could have taken a more active role in getting the two parties to resolve the issues, which you now have to do. We have, by the end of last year, had quite a detailed assessment done on where the contractors had with their issues. And I think when we have fuller time, we'll come and brief you when the contractors give us the root causes for the current issues that they face. We had an assessment done, it aligned and confirmed our schedule, and that's why we now want the contractors to hold them to what they have to do. We have, we've now asked their, like I said, their overseas management to actually be on site on a regular basis with ourselves. So I've asked our finance director that has been dealing this for the last 3 years to actually now physically go to site. The rest of the team is exactly the same from Eskom site. We're bringing in more resources. We're actually spending more money to keep an eye on the contractors, opening our own resources as well. So, and I now expect them to deliver. And we've had good support from our minister. He's engaged with these companies and their chief execs himself. We've been talking to them since December last year already to make sure that they deliver. That, you're correct, the rollout, 1 million solar water heaters. I think we have in the presentation a number, it's about a third. And your question is around most of this funded from government. We don't fund it anymore. We used to fund it, we don't fund it anymore. So I think that is a key issue. We can execute if we need to. We need to make the funding available and roll out. Core risk, I think we'll talk about that. I think currently we believe that the soft power is adequate in terms of the levels. For us, really, the challenge would be, and Dan and Kieran will talk about that, the quality of coal and the pricing of the coal, and we'll deal with that. Then Honourable Nana asked a question around industrial, really an issue around small customers. The reason why in winter we're talking to our domestic customers, that increase in demand of over 3,000 megawatts, in his absence, over 3,000 megawatts, it's really driven by residential customers. So in the evening, it's really our residential customers' behavior, Chairman, that drives the demand. We are doing a lot with the customers. The customers have saved in many areas, and we continue to work with them. So they're also getting a very similar message, and they have, on a voluntary basis, been partnering with us in terms of energy conservation. In terms of the issues that he's talking about, are we hitting back at customers because we're not doing maintenance in winter? The answer is no. It's absolutely not the case that we now, post our MYP3 determination, are hitting back at customers, and the answer is no. I think we've dealt with the question around the buyback. We're not buying anything back from the smelters, from particularly the aluminium smelters. Honourable Fonto raised the question again around the big customers, and the issue around bulletin, we have been quite clear on that. We have put the bulletin contract in front of the regulator to ask the regulator to review certainly the pricing within the contract to make sure that that customer is treated the same all other large customers. You have all reference customers based on the tariffs. They pay the tariff that the regulator pays, except for the bulletin contracts. And that is what we've now placed in front of the regulator. And the regulator will run a process to make sure that they go through the process of public participation process to deal with that specific contract. Then the chair asked a question around 80-10-10. Really, the 10% plan maintenance is on average over the year, so in some parts of the year it will be a lot higher, and then in winter it will be a lot less. So certainly not this winter, we won't get to 10% fully, so that we will do over time. The 4,500 megawatts is currently around 6,500, and we would like to get that down to 4. So that is a positive impact, the current fleet being a lot more reliable. And so if Kuba comes back and many of the other issues are dealt with, and maintenance gets done, the plant will be more reliable. That's actually got a positive impact. So it means 4,500 megawatts of our current fleet is unavailable, not on a planned basis, but on an unplanned basis. So, for instance, we reduce load or emissions, so the coal quality is better, we can keep the units at a higher load. So the plant goes out for an equipment failure. And that's really what we would like to minimize. So if we can maintain the plant, then the car will not break down as you drive towards work. That's really the unplanned advantages. 9 units, I think I have up to that. It really means 9 units being out for quite a long time. Some of the time periods can go into 30, 40 days. What is Eskom's vision beyond 2017? The country should have an energy system that is about double the size that it is now in 3-5 years. It should have an energy system that is making use of all its natural resources, coal that is cleaner, hydro that's available in the region, and an energy system that we believe is integrated with the South African region. So imagine having hydro in the north, having a massive super grid transmission infrastructure, as Mongezi has been talking about, having the nuclear stations on the coastal areas, then using the land spaces for renewable energy, solar should play a role, wind should play a role, and then we must develop the gas resources in the region and in country. Shale gas, the natural gas within the region, that would create a robust energy system that will supply 200 million people with sufficient energy. And we'll deal then with affordability, we'll deal with energy security, we'll deal with energy access, and we'll deal with climate change issues. The one point I'd like to make is that Africa's biggest challenge to deal with climate change has to do with adaptation to climate change. Not so much reduction of the CO2 emissions. It's really how do we deal with adapting the impact of climate change. How do you deal with droughts? How do you deal with impact on transmission networks? How do you deal with many of these systems? And so our choices should be one that conserves water. Our design of our plants should be robust to withstand weather events. When you look at nuclear plants, how do you place that versus sea level rise? So there are many things that are crucially important. Hence the planning issue early is very important. So that would be my sense of what I would see in 30 years' time.
Mr. Thomas, with your permission, can we go straight into the second presentation? It is the securing coal resources for power generation. Mr. Thomas, I don't know who's going to present, but I, with your permission, these slides have been circulated. Can we accept that it has been as read? And because it's quite extensive and in detail, fascinating to go through, but if you can just do it in the best time available to allow for questions. Thank you. Over to you.
Chairman, let Kieran, she's the head of coal at Eskom, or Primary Energy, and Kieran will then take us through the slide.
Thank you. To you, Kieran. Kieran, we started with just reflecting on where Eskom's coal contracts have come from, and we've really broken it down into 3 eras. And you'll see that in each of these eras, there have been specific challenges to Eskom. So we've navigated through eras where we've had limited negotiation power, but still managed to conclude contracts on the basis that Eskom was required to make capital investments in the mining houses from whom they secured resources, to an era where we actually had a surplus capacity, we didn't require so many co-contracts, and an era where the mining industry was producing quite well and meeting Eskom's requirements. And as we move forward, the rest of the presentation will really highlight the significant challenges
that we have to navigate when we bring together Eskom's coal requirements to power the existing power gen, coal fleet to matching it with where the industry is actually going and what we are experiencing as a country. So the historic context, if you can go to the next slide, Torrance, the historic context of how we've operated with the mining industry has led to three specific types of contracts that we have. And our preference is to have long-term contracts where we can provide security of supply on the basis of a coal offtake that guarantees volume, quality, and price. And we have three different types. The first type, as I've alluded to earlier on, is cost plus, where Eskom has made a contribution to the upfront startup capital of the mines, as well as a continuous contribution to keep the mines in operation on the basis that the reserve is actually dedicated to us. But the entering into a contract like this has significant risk, one of which is quality and the other is volume. We've then moved to also engaging in fixed-price contracts, and really fixed-price contracts have enabled the export industry, the export coal industry in the country to take off, where some of the resources are actually jointly dedicated to an export product and an Eskom product. And in the fixed price contract, we are able to negotiate a price that is fixed, but that escalates on an annual basis based on escalation factors that's identified between the two parties. Our short medium-term contracts are fairly similar. These are contracts that we've concluded in bulk in and around 2010. They run mainly up to 2018, and they're really to secure the gap for the short-term shortfall before we reach the era of where we actually have to start opening up significant more mines in this country to meet Eskom's long-term requirements. One of the things introduced in the short term is the ability to pre-certify coal. It is a fairly manual process at this point in time, but what it does guarantee is that even on the short-term contract, we can meet the coal quality requirements of the power stations. It's been one of the success stories in that most of these contracts actually perform quite well when it comes to meeting Eskom qualities. Unfortunately, they're not the bulk of what the power stations require. So if we then move on to just look at how the landscape of performance has changed over a period of time, initially around 2007, the bulk of our mix was on cost plus contracts. And as you can see, as we move forward, short-term, medium-term, and fixed-price contracts are actually taking over the bulk. But what it also means is that many of our short-term contracts are not from mines that are adjacent to power stations, so we've had to change our infrastructure mix. And the infrastructure mode that we're currently using predominantly is road, and we have plans to transform our road infrastructure to rail. Currently, we have three power stations where we can take coal on the rail, so there is a lot of work going on between ourselves and Transnet to maximize the efficiency out of the operations that we can actually get. And in the long term, we are looking at our infrastructure planning on the basis that we migrate more coal from road transportation to rail transportation. So if we move on to the next slide, if you look at South Africa as a country, we have several coal basins. And our supply predominantly comes from the Mpumalanga Basin at this point in time. We have both Matimba and Adupi that take coal from the Waterberg. And then we have a small amount of coal that we take out of the Free State Reserve for Letabo Power Station. One of the things that has to be considered in terms of unfolding future is the issue around logistics in terms of moving coal across long distances in the country. So the tendency is that based on where the power stations are placed, even a long-term view then converges on the continued uptake from the Mpumalanga Basin as well as the Waterberg. So if you can move on to the next slide, where we just try to show the location of all of the power stations. The red triangles just indicate the existing power stations, the blue power stations that we've commissioned from on the return to service. What you will see is that most of Eskom's coal contracts are held by the country's three big mining houses, the Anglo-American Thermal Coal, Billiton Energy Coal South Africa, and Exxaro. We have another emerging player, which is the Glencore Stable, but currently they're not as significant as the three big players that we have. In our future mix, as well as our short-term contracts, the intention is that we then start to diversify this mix on the basis that more significant players can be developed as co-off-takers. So if we then just move to the next slide, and I'll spend a little bit of extra time here just to answer the question from Honourable Member Warman about our stockholding policy. You can see, as has been pointed out, we've increased our stockholding significantly, and it is based on a very concerted policy that looks at the infrastructure challenges as well as physical and other risks in the country at any given time. And what we're actually looking at is how we balance mix between an overall system stock level and a system stock level from station to station. And based on the different risks at the different stations, we've actually looked at the policy that can handle the challenges and the risks that we identify. So while you see an average number of 46 at the moment, it's always likely that some stations are higher than 46 and others lower than 46, based on a very, predetermined view on how to manage risk on power, from a power station to power station basis. Reflecting in the next slide on our current performance and what is really impacting us as Eskom, from a coal cost and volume as well as quality point of view, what you will see is that over time our cost plus contracts have actually produced volumes less than the budget. And that can translate into the challenge which you can see on our short and medium term contracts, which has just contributed to the increasing volumes of coal that we're buying on the short and medium term. As I indicated earlier on, we moved to road, so that brings in a significant logistics challenge. But given that these are shorter term contracts, mostly from mines that have opened up more recently, you will also see that the average cost increases or in the unit cost on these contracts is higher than the cost on the cost of mines. What we've also noticed, or what we also experienced, is that because the cost of mines do not provide us with the volumes that they're supposed to be providing day, year, and year, unit cost increase is actually going up quite significantly and of course significantly higher than PPI and CPI.
Just allow me to spend a bit of time on this. Okay. This is the key issue that we've been discussing within our price application. Most of our coal that we get come from cost plus mines. I think it's currently 60% of our coal supply. So the mines mined by Anglo, Billiton, and Exxaro, if they don't produce the tons right next to the power station, we have to supplement it. And when we supplement it on the right-hand side, we have to buy it at higher prices, and then we have to transport it. And that then increases the cost. So it's crucially important that they deliver what, and that is really what's been impacted, both the cost on those mines and the production level. And then obviously we have to supplement. And that then, there's a direct impact, and Kevin will come to that, as to how we then predict what's going to happen to our price in terms of our coal costs. So that's in our tariff application.
So we move on then to the next few slides, which really then elucidate our observations substantiated by market information as to what is happening in the coal mining sector at the moment. So the first thing that we've seen is that there's been significant underinvestment in the coal mining sector. There have not been significant mines that have opened up in country over the last few years. And what that means is that in an environment where our coal supply requirements are increasing, we will then be forced to compete with other sources of where the coal can be directed to, leading to the argument that there will be an increased alignment going forward between domestic coal prices and export coal prices. We've also seen an era where operating costs in the coal mining industry have been significantly higher than PPI, and some of the contributors are the cyclical commodity prices that the mining industry is subjected to, the rising labor costs that they're subjected to, as well as the fact that the reserve that they're mining in is declining. So you would generally always start to mine the better spots of your reserve and extract the better value product right front. And as you move into the lower value product, it becomes increasingly difficult to mine, so that the amount of coal that you actually get out is decreasing and the costs are actually increasing. There are some other challenges, specifically around infrastructure, road networks, logistical constraints, the high transportation costs, some of which is driven specifically by the diesel input costs into the transportation industry. I talked about the depleted coal resources, and there are concerns around and challenges that the mining industry themselves see with regard to transformation of the coal industry. So as we move forward, the coal market does require substantial investment to recapitalize both domestic and export requirements, and I will reflect on that a little bit later when we look at these challenges as they relate to the electricity supply. Our colleagues at Transnet, have a capital expansion plan that would look to expanding our rail export out of the country from the current about 68 million tons to 81 million tons to meet the port capacity at Richards Bay. And one of the things that ties very much in with this is the forecasted trend that coal prices will trend upwards. And in a latter slide, I will just reflect on where we currently are with this as a country. Now, one of the big challenges for Eskom is that we will not be concerned about an export product leaving this country. If it was a product which was a byproduct or a better product than what we currently wanted. But our big challenge and our big concern comes out of the rising demand for coal out of India specifically, and the fact that Indian power stations use coal that is very similar to the specification that Eskom uses. And that puts the Indian demand in direct competition with the demand for domestic coal in the country. And if you just reflect on the graph that is shown on the right-hand side of the slide, you will see that even with no expansion in the port capacity and the rail capacity currently, the mix of what is taken out of the country has changed significantly from 2005, with a greater portion of exports being directed to the Asian countries like India and China, rather than the European countries, which used to typically take a much higher specification product out of the country. The coal that is demanded by India is what we now call the RP3 specification. It has become a legitimately traded product, hence the access between exporters and suppliers has grown quite significantly with the fact that this product has become traded. So I think we can skip the next slide because I've covered it. And here's the next slide just reflects on the fact that there is increased competition for South African coal, and if you look at the geology of South Africa, it has the ability to supply both the eastern countries and the western countries just simply from its location. So in the next slide, I think it's important to take a look at the price impact of what is happening with exports on domestic coal. So first and foremost, just reflecting, we have seen a significant drop in coal prices from January last year to about January this year. However, in that time, we've also seen a significant weakening of the rand. So if you convert the dollar prices to local currency, the price of coal effectively hasn't changed quite significantly. What we've also, and maybe just a point to note, is that we refer to on these slides ETP, and that stands for export parity price. And what it does is it simply takes the price that is exported out of Richards Bay and converts it to an equivalent energy value in terms of what Eskom would use. So it downgrades Richards Bay product to an Eskom grade product. And even with that, those prices are significantly higher than what Eskom currently contracts coal at. And I must also point out that the prices on the site don't include the cost of the transportation associated with delivering the coal. So the forecast on how world coal market will trend show that in the next few years, there is still the potential of an upside risk in the longer term, while in the medium term, there is a potential of the downside risk. But as is illustrated in the graph above, even on the downside, that does not represent a reduction on the current Eskom coal cost. In fact, it's still significantly higher. So if we then take a look at what this means from a price point of view, you will see on the bottom of the previous slide, there is a little graph where we attempted to work out the impact of an export price on just our shortfall that we don't have contracted at the moment. And what you will see is that if we add, you know, the average price at the moment on an export parity basis in the region of about 450 then, with a transport estimate of about 150 then, if we then look at a price of 600 then a ton delivered, what we will see is that Eskom's operating cost will increase by 5% if we have to contract our current shortfall at export parity prices, and that is quite a significant increase in the cost base of Eskom. So currently, we are about 80% contracted for the next 5 years, and that's on average because it differs from year to year. And if we look forward to this, continue to provide a security of supply for the existing fleet up to Medupi and Kusile, we require 2.1 billion tons of coal, and that is an average of about 40 million tons per annum. Now, if you look at the type of resources that are being allocated by the Department of Minerals and Resources, there are not many resources that will support a over 10 million ton mine, specifically in Mpumalanga. So if you look at the 40 million ton per annum requirement from Eskom, it would translate into about 10 4 million ton mines that have to be opened up just to be able to supply 2018 and beyond. And just looking at the capital that will be required is close to 100 billion rand to open up that many resources. I must also add that one of our concerns is not necessarily around the resource and the number of mines we need to open, but the lead time that it takes to open a mine to be able to do proper geological assessment and mine planning, as well as to manage all environmental issues as per the legislation. And that is one of the concerns in terms of the timing. So if you move to the next slide.
Key issue that you've raised about what happens to power after 2017. Now, power is not just... it has coal to it. This gives you a sense that in 5 years' time, 2018, we need to have this done. And this is just for existing power stations. This is not for new. And then on top of this, there would be a water picture. if you can imagine a water picture for the country, that also has to make sure that future development, the water is there for that. So I think it's quite an important point. This 5 years, we have it contracted, most of it is certain, but beyond that, we certainly need these investments to be made.
So in the next slide, we've attempted to provide you with information about what's happening in the rest of the world. So in recognition of the fact that most countries have a coal-fired fleet and the increasing competitiveness for coal requirements, specifically as I indicated from ER and potentially China, several other countries have introduced legislation to make sure that their coal requirements are met domestically before the export market starts. And these requirements vary across several countries. Some issues like having a domestic market obligation, which needs to be met first before export contracts are put into place, price regulation, as well as export taxes being introduced. There is also a move from countries to be very specific about how resources are allocated in terms of meeting the timelines as well as the capital requirements of unfolding mining development, so that we once again met the domestic supply requirements for power generation. So if we move on to the next slide, we've then said that several things happen in and around the markets that we operate, and they translate into some very direct challenges for coal supply as we currently see it, which then translate into challenges for electricity supply. So the first issue is that we spoke about this earlier, the issue around diminishing quantities and qualities based on the mining in terms of the specific reserve that we have. And the increasing geotechnical risks that we experience. We have some significant challenges with quality at the specific stations. For example, at Tuka Power Station, the coal supply that we get from the dedicated mine is very problematic in terms of quality, and one of the issues that we are always experiencing on the system is load losses due to this quality. So we are busy looking at the plans, both in the short, medium, and long term, to look at how we address the coal quality challenges. As the reserve deteriorates, it would mean that the supply that we secure going forward will have to be beneficiated in some way to make sure that it meets the quality requirements that our current power stations will be able to reliably provide electricity on. The other challenges relate around the thing that we've spoken about before, the issue in terms of the timing as to when potential sources for Eskom are developed, and the fact that the potential sources will, by the suppliers, will always be considered in competition to what Eskom is requiring, specifically from the issues around the higher export penalty price. We've also had challenges within our own environment in terms of how we are utilizing the existing Eskom infrastructure. The issue around moving maintenance also has an impact in terms of reliability and availability on the plant, and it means that it's continuously changing the supply mix that we have to meet in terms of what power stations require. So Khan, I think I've summarized the next three slides in a couple sentences, so we can move to the slide where we start with the tribunal issues. In some recent conversations that have happened in the tribunal around the intervention application, it was quite positive to note from an Eskom point of view that there is a strong validation from the Competition Commission as to how the challenges that are currently being experienced in the country will impact coal supply and specifically the coal supply for domestic use by Eskom going forward in the future. And it is really a very strong substantiation that the trends don't favor domestic coal users, that the translation of these trends will impact coal prices, which will in turn impact electricity prices, and there will then be a serious concern about how the price of electricity then affects the economic growth and the developmental goals of the country in general. So moving forward, some of the things that we believe we will require in terms of enabling us to secure our coal requirements for power generation, some of these trends relate to both the short requirements or enablers relate to both the short and medium term as well as to the long term. But I think as we move forward with a big procurement program to secure our future coal requirements, these enablers need to be in place to make sure that we can power the generation fleet for its current projected life. So the things that we're looking at is the efficient and optimized rail transport options where we can balance export expansion with domestic needs and make sure that our rail infrastructure is operating efficiently to be able to underpin what is actually required. The issues around price stability, as I mentioned before, there's quite a significant impact from the current trends, and if the export market has become more active, clearly it will have an impact on the price, which may be even more detrimental in its impact. And one of the things that we also need to look at is that the trends that and requirements of Eskom are not just about Eskom. Any IPP occupying the coal space would potentially face the same challenges, especially if it has to contribute to an electricity price that we want to be affordable. Access to coal in Mpumalanga and Mossburg is where we will continue to underpin our requirements from, and it really has to do with how our current fleet is built and configured and to be able to meet its quality requirements to ensure its reliability. We've spoken earlier about the timely development of resources, and we really need to look at the mechanisms that need to be put in place on all aspects of the development value chain, from funding to the issuing of perm 3 within reasonable time to be able to enable these resources to come online as they're required. And as we move forward, I think the chief executive talked about a forward-looking picture around the supply mix, and there are other technologies specifically in terms of the cleaner use of coal, like underground coal gasification, that represent a significant portion of the coal mix going forward. Thank you.
A concluding comment from our part. Coal is a strategic resource for the country. It's a resource that many countries have used and must use their natural resources to control the energy costs. And for us, coal has been and will be a very important resource for the country. From our perspective, our view is that we should treat it as such. There should be a balance between what we export from the country, but we should prioritize what we need as a country in order to maintain our energy costs and incentivize the industry to be able to achieve that balance. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Dalmas and your presenter, I think it's clear. So thank you for going very efficiently through the slides. It looks complicated, but the way you explained it, it makes it much easier for us to understand. Members, it opens for questions. Honorable Michael, Kololo, Mokwena, September, Form. Edit. That's Michael.
Thanks for the presentation. Chair, to ask a little bit of clarity, we've seen a report in the newspapers recently about a lot of coal mines supplying coal to Eskom not having water licenses. Chair, and that would render these mines illegal, and that would mean that Eskom buying illegal coal. Chair, we know that Eskom has said that the number has increased to 19. However, we don't know who these specific role players are. In other words, Eskom hasn't named who the coal suppliers are that don't have these water licenses. Chair, I think it's essential that especially a state-owned entity maintains the highest level of adherence to the law, and a water license is obviously terribly important. But Chair, if we could just have the clarity around the water license issue and the names of who these specific suppliers are that don't have the licenses.
Thank you very much. Let me also thank the presentation on coal supply. I've got only two questions actually on the stockpiles. I see that packing still plays a major role in transporting coal from the mines to the power station. I wonder if Eskom is not contemplating using conveyor belts with the degradation of the roads, especially around the areas of Mpumalanga. The roads are very, very bad. I'm not contemplating putting up those conveyor belts to try and alleviate the situation. And then the other one is on the current the power stations that are being built, the Midupi and the Kusile power station. Are they also going to use the low-grade coal, or are they designed to use any kind of coal? Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable McQueen.
Three quick questions. Number one, at the time of Honorable Fakimento, which was chairing the portfolio committee, we made an impassioned plea to Eskom to organize a seminar on the science of coal science, to unpack this mineral, to say how it has come about, what are the byproducts, etc., etc., all this. So we need that, not as just an academic exercise, but just to begin to appreciate more of this black diamond. That's number one. So ESCOM still needs to come back to us about that. I made the referral time mistake, Damas. But you're a good leader. Please organize that for us. That's number one. Number two, the Secretary of NUMA, made a revelation that the coal reserves that we have in this country amounts to some staggering 48 billion tons as a country, and that could last some good 200 years. Can you confirm that or come with an alternative figure? Number three, why is it that there's a perception that we export through Richards Bay our prime coal of high value overseas, and then we remain with low grade oil, coal to our stations, with the result that we want to use too much of coal because of its low capacity, and that has got the concomitant effect on raising the price per unit of electricity.
Wonderful, September.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Can I understand in your presentation why you are not bringing in or juxtaposing the fact that South Africa, again, South Africa's mixed energy program, why that doesn't feature? And I know you're talking about coal, but why does that not feature India? I'm asking this there because we accept that coal dominates South Africa's energy supply, but nevertheless, if you look at the commitments that the country has made, those commitments speaks to one, South Africa has got to change because of your emission problems and your overall climate change commitments that you have made, and then of course we said that a number of new things needs to be explored. I'm further asking this, Chair, because if you look at the matters that are raised in the National Development Plan with regards to this, it shows the one that you are relying on, which are your mining industry. There are particular problems. I think some of them you said there are problems with regards to the policy uncertainties in the mining industry. But at the same time, you also have problems that the mining industry are interested to export more than what they want to give to their domestic country. Now, doesn't that itself continues to create its own problems and own uncertainties, because you are reliant on somebody else here, and that somebody else, from what we read in the National Development Plan, is not quite on board or on the same page as yourself, if I'm correct in analyzing what Arden said there. So that would create a big worry for us if that is the case. Let me rather than ask Chair, what are being done about those challenges that are raised in the National Development Plan with regard to coal and its future and everyone else you are relying on?
Thank you. Honourable Homer?
Yes, thank you. I think I'm coming in on a pretty similar vein. In your slide where you talk about under ESCOM has identified key enablers and you've got domestic access to coal, that section down there,
the water is a strategic resource that needs to be optimally used for a domestic and export coal market. Now, there's a problem in the area with infrastructure. It doesn't make it very easy for business to do business there or to be incentivized to open business. And then related to that is the question of the export, and it's much easier for business then. I mean, why must they struggle where they've got no infrastructure and all of that? So I think my question related to that would be, we can see the challenge, we can see, you know, the problem in the long term here. So what is the proactive step that ISCOM is taking here in dealing with that?
Thank you. Just before I hand over to Mr. Dalmas, the other state-owned company reporting to us is Transnet. We visited last year the Transnet freight rails in the harbour, Richards Bay Harbour, and we witnessed the effort for them to increase. In your slide, you say here that the rail line must increase from 68 million ton to 75 million ton, which I said to us per annum, and eventually in the next 3 years go up to 81 million ton. So that's a capital expansion program of Transnet. Later on the slide, you say that we have to open 10 times 4 million ton per annum mines to supply the quality coal that we need. Is this two strategy working against one another? And as Mr. Dalmas, your remark at the end to say, but we need to declare, coal must be, I think you used the word, a strategic resource. One step further must be to declare it a strategic mineral or a strategic, what do you call coal, item, a strategic item. It must be declared. But at the same time, it earns foreign exchange for export to a country like India. Where do we find the balance? What you're saying, this challenge of capital expansion program from Transnet rail versus we need to open 10 more mines of substantial size to supply the future and the future needs of ESCOM. And secondly, linking up to the question of Honourable September, the President has announced in December and also in the State of the Nation address, all government departments must be aligned to the National Development Plan. When the Minister Pravin Gordhan announced his budget in February, he is financing the National Development Plan. So if all government departments are aligned to the National Development Plan, how is ESCOM aligned to the National Development Plan as far as your future coal vision is concerned, or coal supply, security of coal supply is concerned? Can I hand over to you with no more questions, and then for you to reply.
Thank you, Chair, and the team will certainly again add. On the question from Honourable Michael, from our perspective, very right. I mean, we have, in slide four, we've given a clear indication as to the mines where the water licenses are standing. We can certainly provide you with a list. I don't have it with me now. We have been quite clear as to what our requirements are. This is an issue, as far as we're concerned, between the mine operator and the Department of Water Affairs, and we have been quite clear that certainly those mines must be submitting the applications to the department. We are aware that there's been quite a backlog at actually getting through the approval of the water licenses. But really it is up for the Department of Water Affairs to then take action. But we will raise it again with them, that we can see the list. Honourable, I want to ask a question around quite a major portion that is based on roads, and that's correct. It impacts on the cost, it impacts on the roads in Mpumalanga, it impacts on safety, which is a big issue for us, public safety, you know, lots of accidents with coal trucks. And why aren't we building conveyor belts? We have an optimal distance for conveyor belts. I think, if I can recall, it's something like 17 kilometers or so. So anything beyond that, we would not use conveyor. So really the solution is then a solution of building a railway line. And so a big solution must be, and maybe it's not answering the final question as well, the investment into export lines for coal versus a needed investment to start linking with rail, mines, and power stations. We have done two in the last 2 years. We're now doing 10 million tons, and the Department of Public Enterprises have put together a program where jointly with Transnet, we actually work on making sure the investment happens in terms of, we're now building a line to Majuba. We just finished one to Tatuka, and we finished one to Camden. We're now at, I think, 10 million tons of coal on the rails. So we really want to ship that 30 million tons off the coal truck onto the railway.
May I add to that, literally in the last 3 years, we have more than doubled the volume of coal that we move using rail away from the tracking. The challenge is linked to what I said by Gideon earlier on, that as the cost-plus mines, which are across the fence from the power stations, under the form, we have to make the shortfall with medium-term sources that are actually lying it all over places, not necessarily close to the infrastructure, rail infrastructure. We are reviewing our logistics plan that we drafted in 2008. We are reviewing it to look at a solution where we begin to introduce consolidation terminals that will help create more volumes closer towards the rail solutions. And together with that, we'll also integrate the logistics of moving the limestone that we require for fluid that gets sulfurized for our power station consumption. So we're really looking at how to change this model by rearranging the linkages as well.
If I deal with the question of Madupi and Kusile, and it's actually true for all of our power stations. Eskom and Africa has both power stations next to coal reserves. So that's why we have all these big stations, and that's why we use conveyors and actually have much cheaper coal. And that's the first thing. So the station is actually designed for coal fields, so you just pick the coal field, and then you build a power station. And that's how we've done it, and with Madupi and Kusile is the same. Madupi is designed to build the coal from the coal fields next to it, and Kusile is designed to burn the coal from the coal field that you call the New Largo coal field. So, and that's how we do the design. Now, we have over decades of this actually built up quite a capability of burning lower quality coal, not necessarily high quality. So we actually, our power station is designed for that. And the reason why that is because as you mine, you do get two products. You get a good high quality value product, and you can derive higher benefit out of that by exporting it, but you also generate at the same time a lower, unless you use it, it just lies there. And so that has been, over time, the model that has been built, where you have Eskom and Trafica been using that resource very effectively. Now, yes, going forward, we do need a higher quality because it allows us to operate our stations efficiently. What we're now getting is, unfortunately, very poor, extremely poor qualities. So we just want to get to a point where the qualities meet what the stations are designed for. So Madupi and Kusile are designed for the actual coal where they're located. So as soon as we start moving coal around, one of the key things we need to do, and that goes on Dan's point, is we need to mix the coal to make sure that the mix eventually supply the station's requirements. And hopefully that clarifies that. And that leads me to the question from Andrew Mokwena, and therefore it's very useful that we do a seminar, and we will arrange that. We call it Coal 101, and the reason why Kiran talks about India, if you think way back, and they will tell you in seminar, way back when the continents were all together, where did India break off from? From Africa. And so you end up with the geology very similar. And that's why you have this very similar geology and the designs of the stations being similar around the need for coal. And you see, but we can do that. Where does coal come from and how much coal we have? And I think that leads to the second one, Kiran. I don't know if you... We have just done a study from the Council of Geoscience. South Africa has got a lot of coal. The question is where the coal is. I think the first point is the Mpumalanga coal reserves in South Africa is depleting. And the rest of the coal reserves are, as Kieran has indicated there, and so is in the north. And that's the Waterberg issue. And to get to the Waterberg, we need to deal with logistics. We need to get rail up there. We need to get water up there. And the President's project
around SIP 1, Strategic Integrated Project 1, was exactly to address that issue. How do you make sure you leverage the Northern Belt? Because it's not just for Eskom, it's for Western, it's for the future mining that needs to happen. The project is there. On that specific one, Eskom would be leading it, and the other companies will be executing it. Water, the rail from Transnet, so that is how that's being addressed. I don't know if you want to add to that.
Yeah, maybe I can add, we don't have the detailed numbers here, but a very recent quantification of the entire South African coal reserve based on information, geological information that is being collected by experts as well as mining industry information was completed by the Council for Geosciences. It does substantiate the point that there are extensive coal reserves in the country, but it equally well substantiates the point that the future reserves are the lower quality reserves, so meeting the existing requirements of Eskom will require that coal is blended or washed in any specific way so that we can get the product up that we need. But we can certainly provide the information on the quantification of the reserve in the different areas of the country.
Just to input from Karen, the importance of this independent study done by the Council of Geosciences is that it will help us close the debate about different perspectives on what the country resource side looks like. So we can start focusing on so what are we going to do next, because there's been quite a lot of debates, different views, which leads to an impasse in as far as decision-making is concerned. And the information was submitted by all players to an independent party that verified, and then the emerging picture will result in what we, what will be next for us to do as far as the coal resource is concerned. I think the question from Honorable September relating to the energy mix begins to question or maybe ask what is it that the picture of coal in our fleet, what does it do to the anticipated greening of our generation mix going forward? That's my understanding of it, essentially. If you recall, the IRP 2010's anticipation is a significant growth, almost a doubling up of generation capacity. And they're going to be made up of nuclear, wind, solar, and the others. In this picture that we showed around the coal requirements going forward, our requirements are based on existing power stations and some of our stations towards the end, the older ones will be decommissioned. So there is no net growth in as far as any coal commitment is concerned, but what's happening, filling up the gap of the overall capacity is the coming on stream of other generation bases like nuclear going forward. So there's no, much of coal stays fairly similar, and the growth is seen in other technologies to make up for the balance of the requirements of our utilities. And I think that's how I understood the question to be coming through.
And the question from Honourable Borman, I think we have tried to deal with that in terms of the infrastructure that's there. Chairman, you asked a question around transport CapEx. CapEx for exports are crucially important. We recognize that. Does that compete with the new mine CapEx? New mine CapEx is really what the private sector, and that's why it is important that we do have exports, because it's very important that we then see the cap investment in mining happening. The state-owned mining company playing a role, I think that would be important to see that investment. And between, as I've indicated, between ourselves and Transnet, we have coordinated our CapEx needs for an integrated rail network and Transnet expansion. And certainly the Department of Public Enterprise, within our shareholder complex, Chairman, you would know that they actually have a target, both of us, to make sure that we move more coal onto rail from that perspective. Where does this balance? Many countries have achieved a balance between exports and domestic. Yes, there's a need for exports so that we generate revenues as a country, but also that the mining sector generates returns to invest, capital both us and the state. But you can find ways of dealing with that, where you provide a low-quality product at a consistent volume at a price that is predictable. To have us competing with coal on an export parity price would directly impact our energy costs. That's really what we're saying. You can find a balance between that. Prioritize the local demand. Anything beyond that, certainly we should beneficiate and make with enough coal to then do that. I think your last question around the alignment with the National Development Plan, we certainly have in RANCO, we have engaged with the Commission in before the report was completed. We've extensively went through this analysis and certainly we'll be finding ways to now move on to implementation to ensure alignment. Chair, I think that's where I can stop.
Anything from your side? we're coming to the end of this marathon session of 3 hours. I think you will agree with me it was worth a while. And thank you for coming to Parliament to explain. We wish you well in your program, Peter Peak. We wish you well in finding this balance between supply and demand and in your coal security supply. And I think we want to express the wish and the authority and the that you will keep the lights on. But it will happen with a national effort. It has to be a national effort by all of us. And in that regard, we thank you for your presence here and for your presence, your two presentations. We thank all the members from the department, the staff members, the media, for attending the session. I think it was worth it. Thank you for members of Parliament for taking out the 3.5 hours asking the different questions. Thank you for answering all the questions. And we would wish you well going into winter, and we will be in touch with you. Members, so this brings us to the end of this session. We're going to ask members to stay for this one item on the agenda list. A body break for 3 minutes. Therefore, ESCOM to be able to move out of the room and members can return. I promise you it will not be more than 5 minutes. Thank you.
Is the minister that adopted the budget vote report? The first page, that is opening and welcoming remarks. Second page, number two, is consideration adoption of the budget report. The report as presented, it outlines the following, which are the strategic plan of the department, strategic priorities of the department, the annual performance plan, the budget of the department, strengthening capacity within the department, committee observations and recommendations. Then includes an amendment from the committee related to that, the increased oversight to ensure that South African Express will complete the construction of the withdrawn financial statements and then the get table department. And then also that concern regarding the department's budget declining, whereas the establishment was expanding. And then the adoption of the report that the DA and Congress of the People, they would not be able to vote on the report as it is confirmed. The consideration of, then the report was adopted. Consideration of adoption of the minutes, those two sets of minutes. And then the issue of the program that was had to be rescheduled the meeting of the 10th of May.
Any comments? Proposal to adopt? Honorable Marais, second. Honorable Kodolo. Agree to? Next meeting is next Tuesday. South African Express Airways, two financial statements outstanding, and annual report. Next Tuesday, same time, same place. Keeping adjourned. Thank you.